The robed figure pushed past me, walking stiffly. People turned to stare at him, terrified. Stop, I yelled. The stranger began to twirl, round and round, faster and faster. The gym lights flashed off and on, off and on. I felt as if I were spinning too, faster and faster, round and round. Everyone in the gym seemed stunned, unable to move. The stranger stopped spinning and stabbed the air with both hands. A low hum buzzed through the air. It grew louder and louder until finally the hum became a roar, the roar of a speeding plane about to crash. People were screaming now, screaming and running for cover. The food table suddenly burst into flames. I headed toward the basketball booth. Right before I reached it, it exploded. Screams echoed through the gym, the air filled with smoke. I've got to find Amanda, I realized. A buzz. Something dove toward my head. I ducked. Wasps! They buzzed through the air, darting and diving. Get me out of here, a man pleaded. He threw himself against the door and banged on it furiously. It wouldn't open. It was locked.
Hello.
And welcome
to Say Podcast and Die,
the podcast where two queers sit in their closet and talk to you about Goosebumps.
I'm Alyssa.
I'm Andy.
And today we are talking to you about Goosebumps Series 2000, number 18, Horrors of the Black Ring.
Yeah, I had never even really heard of this one before you looked up the title last week.
Yeah, let's talk about this cover.
This cover is the jewelry box of a guy who does Ren Fairs.
I think it looks like H.R. Giger's jewelry box.
Oh, that's a really good point. Yes. We have a ring centered with kind of pincers. The monster face inside it is alarming. It kind of has the texture of a turkey neck.
But the mouth is reminiscent of mandibles.
Yeah, like that coming from the side. Mm-hmm. And then it has a skull nose or like a missing nose.
Yeah.
Freaky looking.
Mm-hmm.
And we get no information about this backstory. What is this thing? Where does it come from?
Nope. Bird's eye view of the plot. Chirpy's eye view of the plot.
Chirpy.
We follow Beth, a so-called goody-goody, who is in charge of her school's carnival fundraiser. And she has a seven-year-old sister, Amanda, a bully named Anthony, a crush on a boy named Danny.
That's her very own bully.
Yeah. And the sort of first part of the book revolves around things going wrong with the carnival preparations and then with the carnival itself. It turns out, to her surprise, her favorite teacher, Miss Gold, is behind it. And Miss Gold had found this ring, supposedly in the school parking lot. It falls off of her as she's taken away by the police, and Beth picks it up and then suddenly can't get the ring off. And then after that, she's seized with the urge to do, you know, quote-unquote evil things, like break Anthony's sunglasses, and she's tempted to create like a dozen kid pile up in a bike-a-thon. And
yeah, so she's a Beth, but she's also a Carly Beth, but amped up several degrees for Goosebumps Series 2000.
So we find out that the ring is possessed by some sort of creature. We don't get any details, but it wants to take her body and do evil things.
It's a slappy kind of motive.
Yeah, but she manages to get the ring off and puts it on Chirpy, who has died, bird.
Chirpy's a little bird with a broken wing she rescues at the beginning.
And then it dies. And that works, apparently. And she goes and buries it in the backyard. And then her sister Amanda comes home with her very own black ring.
The motif of Chirpy slowly dying on the back porch over the course of this book, it wrecks me, really.
Yeah.
This is one of the more hopeless books in the Gooseverse.
Yeah. Do you think it has anything to do with the sort of slow death of the series?
It might be, yeah. Because it's like a bird, which is, and it's Goosebumps, you know, we've talked about the bird theme.
Yeah, it's interesting. We'll get into it. But the version that we read was, I guess, kind of like, it looked more like an EPUB, but you could really see from the way it was structured how little text there was.
How much blank space, yeah.
How much blank space, yeah. Well, let's get into it.
So we start with Beth Welch and her seven-year-old sister Amanda, who she describes as mosquito-like.
Amanda wants Beth to take her to the petting zoo so she can shoot rubber bands at the goats.
And we have another one of those setups like, they don't look similar even though they're related.
Yeah, exactly. Beth has red hair.
And cargo pants.
Yeah.
You know?
One of the ways in which they look different.
And another way in which they're different is Amanda's kind of a messed up child. Well, I guess it turns out not to be different though, because Beth learns to embrace her own inner messed up child.
Yeah.
Amanda wants to go to the petting zoo because she likes to shoot rubber bands at the goats.
And Amanda loves to say that Beth promised her that she'd do X, Y, and Z when Beth has made no such promise. Like, another thing she wants her to do later is help her line up her Barbies from ugliest to hottest. And yeah. Beth is like, they're Barbies. They all look the same. And Amanda's like, uh-uh.
I mean, I remember feeling similarly as a kid, though.
Mm-hmm.
I know that they have the exact same face, but I definitely thought Ballerina Barbie was superior to the aerobics Barbie.
This conversation is interrupted by Anthony Gonzalez, who's at first pretending that he can't brake and is going to be hit by a truck. But actually, it turns out he's mostly been picking on Beth because she was elected to the carnival committee and no one wanted to elect him because he's kind of a troublemaker.
But he's picked on her before this. He told her a couple years ago that her cat, Benson, which I feel like these books are looking back, sort of like the end of the original series did. These series 2000 are looking back. And Benson, remember, was the last name of the family in Welcome to Deadhouse.
I'd totally forgotten that.
Yeah, Amanda Benson. And Amanda also.
Oh,
we're just recycling some names here. But anyway, he told her cat was dead. Her cat wasn't. And then her cat did die of old age, though, last year. And Anthony laughed about it when she told him.
Yeah.
And then he wants to be on the carnival committee, which makes me think of him as kind of a John Wayne Gacy. He's a joiner and a sociopath. So him wanting to be on the carnival committee and being jealous of Beth doesn't explain why he's trying to kill animals in front of her.
No, it doesn't.
He first targets a bird with his bike, and then he squashes a worm. He's like, bikes are good for crushing things.
Yeah, and he's like, Beth, you're such a goody-goody for liking animals, because she picks up this bird and wants to bring it to safety.
And Amanda also laughs her head off when he crushes a worm to death.
Yeah. Amanda seems to have sort of shifting allegiances, and it seems like she really likes to push Beth's buttons. The other thing about Anthony is that he's very proud of his very dark sunglasses, which his brother bought him, and they're $100.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that'll come up later. This is one thing I'll say for this book. Everything that it lays down comes up later.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it was sort of shoehorned in because they needed a plot resolution. Even if it was sort of shoved out on the back porch and left to die because they needed a plot resolution.
Well, speaking of which, Beth brings the bird home to her mom, who takes it to the vet, and she's late to school. And her teacher, Miss Gold, is very understanding about how important it is to take care of animals, more important than school. And Beth tells
great. Him, yeah. I love that idea.
Me too. And Beth is like, this is why she's everyone's favorite teacher.
That, and also Beth thinks she's hot. Mm-hmm. In a weird way, she's like, oh, I love her shiny golden hair and her twinkling eyes and her perfect teeth. Like, is she a horse? Like, are you, what century is this?
Yeah. She's just like, oh, and she looks like she's young enough to be one of us, kind of.
Yeah, because she's got freckles across her nose. Mm. Yes, this is an exceptionally serious 2000 book because it has inappropriate adult-child relationship, it has animal cruelty, and it has the depressed wheeze of a series on its as it winds down.
Yeah. This scene is also when we learn that Miss Gold found a black ring in the school parking lot, and she put it on, but just until she can figure out who owns it, you know?
And, right.
Which is, it's a good thing no one's come forward to claim it, because she can't get it off.
Yeah. Yeah, she's an odd duck, and she doesn't want to do her work ever. She's no. like, you don't need to do homework. You have a carnival coming up, and she'll pull stuff like that this later, too.
And all the kids are like, gee, what a good teacher. And I'm like, she's a lazy teacher.
Yeah.
Work smarter, not harder, I guess. Beth takes a closer look at the ring, because she's very fascinated with it, and it seems like an opportunity to just, you know, get close to Miss Gold.
Yeah.
And it's black, and it has some sort of what Miss Gold describes as a flaw in it. There's some sort of, like, fogginess in it, and it almost looks like a face.
Mm-hmm. And neither of them can stop staring at it.
Mm-hmm.
So we cut to, speaking of hands and stuff, art.
Hands and stuff.
Well, I want to talk about hands later. But we cut to art class, where Beth is trying to paint two hands clasped together, which she says is a symbol of brotherhood. And the students are going to be selling these paintings. So she's making a painting. Everyone's making a painting. They're going to be selling them at the school carnival. So this is an underfunded district, I take it.
Yeah, but they have money for art supplies.
Yeah, I think that this is diminishing returns.
Yeah, because they're doing painting, but some students, like Danny, are doing sculpture.
But they're surely not selling it for the price of the materials. I think you're right.
Anthony is painting Beth in a very unattractive way.
Mm-hmm.
She's squicked out by this, but she also uses it as an opportunity to go over to Danny because he's just criticized her painting. So she thinks, aha, I can ask Danny how to fix my painting.
Yeah, and I can get him to model for me with his great hands. She's got, now that I'm talking about, yeah, a lot of this is her focusing on the hands of people she likes.
Well, Anthony tries to pick on them again. He and Danny get into a fight, and ultimately Beth feels like this works out well because then she and Danny walk to the cafeteria together.
Yeah, they have a mutual enemy. It's a great basis for a relationship.
Yeah. And as they're walking to the cafeteria, they hear someone shrieking, and it's Miss Gold. They run into the classroom and someone has written on the board over and over, "The carnival is doomed."
Yeah, Miss Gold, calm the hell down. Why are you screaming? It's not like it's in blood. And then she's so...
It's in chalk, yeah.
Yeah, she's so overwhelmed by this that she can't even clean the chalkboard herself. Danny and Beth have to volunteer to do it.
This moment felt very much to me like, oh, I'm a person in my 30s reading a book for 8-year-olds where I was like, the carnival is doomed. Those are the stakes. It gets better later on. But at this point, I was like, come on. Like, in the past, we've had, like, you will die.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I think that the world that Beth is living in has a lot more dangers in it than the world that Miss Gold is living in.
Unless her salary depends on this fundraiser.
That's true. That's a good point. And it might.
Anthony shows up and appears to have chalk on his hands.
Yeah, he says it's just clay from the clay pots he was cleaning up. Unsurprisingly, the one character who appears like he might be a person of color is the one who's getting blamed for stuff.
Uh-huh. Which will turn out to not be his fault.
So the next day we get the Barbie thing, where Amanda wants Beth to help her line up her Barbies. She says, "Surfer Barbie's beautiful and Rollerblade Barbie, not so hot."
Yeah, it's hot or not, the Barbie edition.
I mean, Amanda seems like a kind of kid I would at least be interested in talking to, even if she is scary.
Because she likes to put things into categories and arrange them according to various qualities.
We could have her as a guest, is all I'm saying.
Ouch, it's fair. Well, Beth says she has carnival stuff to do. We also get an update from Mom that the bird has a broken wing, but is in the backyard.
Not eating.
Beth goes out there, tries to feed him some seeds, names him Chirpy.
Oh, I almost forgot. Do you remember what Amanda's side project is besides Barbie arranging for the weekend?
Oh, yeah. Someone has given her a cow eyeball. This book is so wild that I forgot about the subplot. Somebody in her class gave her a cow eyeball, and she says that her science project is going to be to dissect it.
And this is a self... she chose this science project. No one... Her teacher was like, go do a science project. Probably expecting kids will come back with, you know, tornadoes in a 2-liter or whatever. And this little girl is going to come back with a dissected cow eyeball.
I cut up this eyeball.
Right. And you're just like, oh, okay.
And also, I don't feel like she's going to do a dissection. I think she's going to get a knife and cut it open, which is different.
And yep, she's going to be like labeling the parts like goo. More goo.
I was supposed to label it. Well, someone, before Beth leaves, someone calls and tells her to stay away from the carnival. Stay away from school.
And is this Miss Gold?
I think that's what we're supposed to think. She has her own line, though, and Amanda is on the phone. So Amanda says, oh, no, it wasn't me. But Beth thinks it's her.
There's a lot that doesn't make sense about this, though, because, like, why does either Miss Gold or the ring want Beth not to come to the carnival and then later wants to steal her sister?
So I could see the reasoning for it being Miss Gold is maybe it is Miss Gold wanting to keep her safe.
Oh.
And I could also see it very much being Amanda taking revenge, because later we learn she feels bad that she's not getting enough attention from her sister.
That's true.
She goes to school. She and Danny show up and they go to the art room to finish some art projects. And the art room is trashed.
Yes, and we also get the most horrifying moment of the book, which is when Danny says, oh, I'm going biking. And Beth says, oh, that sounds fun. Maybe we can go together. And Danny just doesn't respond.
That was harsh.
Oh, I felt pain.
Yeah.
And triggered by that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the art room's trashed except for the painting of Beth, which has blood dripping from her mouth. I mean, why would the ring want this to happen unless it's specifically a ring aiming at Beth the whole time?
Or there'll be no art sales here. Yeah, some of this is like, it is kind of hard to see how the ring would be involved, but I have no idea.
Yeah.
Or maybe Miss Gold is just taking out some rage on Beth or the ring is taking it out. I'm not sure. Maybe the ring knows that she's the next target. I really have no idea.
Well, Miss Gold, at the very least, seems to be continuing to phone it in. So instead of teaching that day, she sends all the kids up to the art room to make new paintings.
They're like, oh, she's the best.
And then she sits, appearing to talk to her ring.
I feel like she went outside and had a smoke. I think that's what happened. After school, Beth and Tina and Danny go, they're, you know, carnival committee, they go to bake cookies in the home ec room, unsupervised, which was surprising.
Uh-huh, because they're 12, right? 11
yeah.
to 12.
I mean, I guess that makes sense. But then they do set the oven on fire.
It doesn't make sense for a school. You know, yeah. I feel like you're supposed to keep an eye on people.
There should at least be a teacher in a corner reading a magazine.
Well, and it's not just that they, like, the cookies start burning. Beth opens the door and the oven bursts into flames and fire comes roaring out of it.
And then the school catches on fire.
And then they see Anthony. They pull the fire alarm and they see Anthony, and Beth says, you seem to always be around when something bad happens.
Yeah.
Like, so are you, though.
It's true. Beth goes home. She sees that Chirpy isn't looking so great. We get a scare when Amanda jumps out of her closet.
We get one of the most real moments of the book, which is Mom standing in front of the TV with her purse slung over her shoulder. Doesn't that just take you back?
Yeah.
Sitting on the couch watching TV, Mom's just stalled.
Yeah.
Doing too many things.
Yeah.
Never took her purse off when she came in the door.
Or is about to go out, but is stuck watching something on TV.
Exactly. We get this kind of nice moment, one of the first good sibling moments since Night of the Living Dummy 2, where Amanda explains to Beth, the reason I've been so pesky is because I really miss that you used to spend more time with me. Mm-hmm. It's kind of nice.
It is nice.
Of course, later that night, the cow eyeball has somehow ended up in Beth's bed.
So. Yeah. So it might all be a ploy. So when Beth goes to school, it seems like there's been this really nice thing of kids baking things at home and bringing them to make up for what happened. You know, this real coming together. And Beth decides she's going to sneak a brownie from the fundraiser. And she puts it in her mouth and it's full of maggots.
Good fucking God. How did that even happen?
I know.
I like, there's, again, this is another thing where I'm like, was that the ring? Was that just someone being really disgusting?
I don't know. I mean, I think we're supposed to assume it's the ring. Beth, you know, vomits it up. They get rid of all the maggot-filled stuff. And Miss Gold, at this point, suggests, you know, why don't we cancel the carnival?
Oh, yeah. And
the principal's like, no, it's too late.
Yeah, the principal's not interested, slash doesn't have a backup plan. So then they are setting up the dunk tank, and Danny wants to try it. So Anthony throws the thing, and he falls in, and the water's boiling.
Yeah, that was horrifying.
I know, I thought he was, I mean, so if this was real, he would die, because the water's literally boiling.
Yeah, yeah.
Or he'd be, like, horribly burned.
Yes. And Anthony gets blamed for this, too.
Because yeah, they don't get him right away.
No.
They have to, like, find someone who can do it. Yeah.
Yeah, and again, the principal won't call off the carnival.
Seems like a real Jaws mayor slash political leaders during COVID situation.
Yeah. It's the night of the carnival. Beth is very apprehensive. Amanda's super excited to go eat hot dogs. And Beth is like, ha, 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 ha. Yeah, the food, huh? At the carnival.
It's going to be great.
So they go. And at first, everything seems to be fine. Beth works the ticket booth at first. And she's selling tickets for $1.
And Anthony says he'll keep an eye on Amanda, which he doesn't really seem to be doing. He kind of disappears pretty quickly.
Yeah. And then a hooded figure comes up to the front and then slips by her without paying a dollar.
The masquerade scene in Phantom of the Opera? Mm-hmm. That's this moment.
Yeah. Again, $1 tickets, probably not going to cover the costs of this whole fundraiser.
No. Maybe it's a fund loser. Maybe it's a money laundering scheme. And that's how it's a fundraiser.
Well, the figure starts going after Amanda, it seems. And so Beth runs after it and all hell breaks loose.
Yeah. All this stuff happens. Like, water starts pouring out of the dunk tank. The food table bursts into flames. The basketball booth explodes. A swarm of wasps appears.
Yeah. And the doors are suddenly locked so people can't get out. Everyone is panicking.
Yeah, it reminds me of the Scream School incident, actually.
Mm-hmm. And Beth finally catches up to the figure and unhoods it. And the figure has, at this point, picked up Amanda and is carrying her away. And the figure turns out to be Miss Gold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the policemen catch the figure and pull off the hood, and it's like, oh, shit.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like Beth doesn't even react as much, oh, shit, as she should be reacting.
No.
But maybe she doesn't have the context to know, like, what this looks like.
Mm-hmm. Well, Miss Gold drops the ring, and as the police are taking it away, Beth picks it up, and she puts it on and then can't get it off.
And she sees the face inside laughing. Later, we learn that Miss Gold's first name is Melanie.
Yeah. And the principal publicly announces on television that she's been taken to a mental hospital.
Yeah, Marchfield Hospital, which I assume is the Arkham of this universe.
Yeah.
Chirpy's still not eating. I hate this subplot.
Yeah, me too. Beth starts to feel different. She has an extended dream sequence.
So cool. Our bird children thing that Arlstein has been building since Welcome to Dead House. It kind of really comes to fruition where you have a bunch of ducks with children heads, and Beth goes around ripping their heads off and rubbing the blood on the ring to get it off.
Yeah.
That was, like, so metal.
Yeah.
What a great moment.
Before going to bed, her mom had tried to get it off with, like, grease, and it hadn't worked, and so in the dream she's saying, only blood will get the ring off.
Yeah, and she's, like, feeling her way around a maze and everything's greasy.
Mm-hmm.
It's so cool.
And when she wakes up, her room is covered in feathers because she's basically destroyed her pillows.
Yeah, and that's the first sign we get that she might not be totally in control of her actions.
Uh-huh.
So she starts vacuuming so she won't have to talk to her mom about it.
Good response.
Yeah.
Well, she decides that she has to talk to Miss Gold about what happened. She sneaks into the hospital. She comes up with this pretty clever plan to figure out where Miss Gold is because she's not actually seeing visitors, or the nurse won't allow her to see visitors.
Especially children from their school.
Yeah, the sister of the person she tried to abduct. But she figures out where she is and sneaks in. And Miss Gold tells her to get rid of the ring and freaks out when she sees that Beth has it, but won't really elaborate beyond that.
Seems like she doesn't really know much about
it. It's true.
It's kind of like the sign of the werewolf. It's kind of this just thing that is also in the book.
Yeah.
From The Werewolf in the Living Room.
Beth goes home, and for the first time, she kind of snaps at her sister and calls her stupid. And then she starts calling her Barbie's names, too. And, like, it's clear she's not very practiced at name calling because she says her Dr. Barbie. We'll call her Dr. Dum Dum.
Yeah, because
like 12.
Amanda's like, she was calling the dolls, like, dopey and airhead and brainless. And Amanda's like, you can't call them brainless. One's a doctor. I'm like, oh, you haven't met PhDs. But yeah, it is stressful. There's something about her being like Dr. Dum Dum when she's like a 12-year-old that is, I actually find more alarming.
We also learn that the school is going to be, well, is it the school doing or is it just the bike-a-thon just happening?
You know, a bike-a-thon is happening and it is also for charity. And it's another one of those things, much like the carnival fundraiser, where I'm like, I don't understand what role does the biking play in raising money? It's always bothered me about a-thons. Like, you're just going around asking people to give you money. You don't, like, yeah. Biking doesn't accomplish anything.
Yeah. Well, so we've set that up. And Beth gets to school and she sees Anthony show up on his bike. And she starts to feel like she almost has superpowers. She's so angry. He goes inside. And when no one is looking, she just destroys his bike.
Yeah, she bends his front wheel and she crushes the back one and she feels this surge of power. Again, Carly Beth style, where she's just like, haha, I can do anything.
Now that I'm not repressing my emotions. They go to class and they have a substitute. And so she takes the opportunity of everyone being distracted to steal Anthony's sunglasses, smash them in the bathroom, and then deposit the pieces on his seat. And because she's such a, you know, quote-unquote goody-goody, he never suspects that it's her.
But he's furious.
They're expensive.
Everything that happens from here on out between Beth and her sister must be really weird because from Amanda's perspective, she's like, well, I finally went and told my sister that I just really wanted her to spend more time with me. And then she started being a complete monster.
Yeah.
For the first time ever.
Oh, so, you're right.
Lesson learned.
Oh, geez. Yeah. Don't share your feelings.
Yeah.
So I can kind of understand taking revenge on Anthony, right? You know, again, haunted mask style. But then she decides to just shove a fifth grader into a locker. She doesn't even know the kid. And then she finds a mouse and drops it into soup and waits for somebody to eat it. She drops a mouse into hot soup.
A live mouse, yeah.
Yeah.
And she thinks, it felt good being bad. And now I see why Anthony's always doing mean things to people because it's so much fun.
See, this really freaked me out because it's like, there are just some people who love to cause chaos and watch the world burn. And I'm like, oh, geez.
Well, and it's one thing causing chaos. Like, I feel like that's, you know.
That's what our dogs
do. Annoying, but she wants to specifically hurt people.
Yeah.
And I think that if we had a Goosebumps Series 2000 checklist, the one that this hits is bully as a protagonist.
Mm-hmm. So that day, she continues her streak by going home and cutting the legs off of Amanda's Barbies.
Like, holy shit, yeah.
Amanda's really upset, and she tells her mom that she didn't do it, and it's clearly very conflicting for both mom and Amanda because they're like, yeah, she'd never have done this, but there really couldn't have been any other person.
Right. And actually, to your point about being scary that there are just people like this, it reminds me of that documentary that we both watched about it follows like three or four different boys who are just like have huge anger management problems.
I think it's called Dangerous Son.
Yeah. And you see their parents trying to deal with it, protect the siblings from them.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's clear in those cases too, that the kids can't control it. They just have a lot of rage more than most people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Beth has these waves of regret, but she can't get the ring off. She tries every night, but it doesn't go anywhere.
And she really worries that she can't stop herself.
Mm-hmm.
Even as she's enjoying it, she's kind of worried but she doesn't feel in control.
Yeah. Yeah, so, it really did remind me of that documentary.
Yeah. So she just does all this stuff. Like, she tears up Amanda's homework, replaces her shampoo with corn oil, which was very specific.
Yeah.
Have you even ever seen corn oil, like, in the store?
No.
Unless that's what a canola secretly is. I don't know. I was never clear on that. puts slugs in her spaghetti sauce.
That's disgusting.
Mm-hmm. Pours soda on a girl's laptop at school.
Yeah.
And then the one I don't want to talk about. Do you remember what happened?
No.
A hamster.
Oh, God. Yeah, I repressed this.
She locks the class hamster in a room with a stray cat.
Yeah, and then Danny, who's responsible for it, has to go clean up its mangled corpse. Oh, yeah, I repressed that.
I also feel like maybe an editor going through this would be like, let's not give kids ideas.
Yeah, you'd think.
You know, they have no judgment.
Mm-hmm. The day of the bike-a-thon arrives, Danny shows up. She's forgotten about it. She's in her PJs. And he says, but it's for charity.
And, oh, yeah, he's so judgmental.
Oh, yeah, and we don't ever find out what charity. And then she says she doesn't want to, and he said, I never thought you could be so selfish.
Yeah, what, he's such asshole. A dick.
Yeah.
She's like, fine, I'll go. And then she's there, and the whole time she's just like, I could make everyone crash. I could snap the cord off Anthony's handbrakes, and he's going to be the fastest, and then all these kids will pile up, and she's just like gleefully imagining that. And then she's like, fuck, I gotta get out of here.
Yeah, so she goes home, and she goes into the garage where the sort of woodworking stuff is. She sees Chirpy in his cage. He's already dead, and she thinks...
I mean, for him, I feel like he's like, I'm finally dead. Thank God.
And she thinks, oh, Mom must not have wanted me to see this on the big day. There's a small part of me that's like, did you do it, though?
Yeah. She does not remember, maybe.
She tries to use tools to get the ring off, but then the room fills with smoke, and a creature appears.
Yes, it says the evil has outgrown the ring and now I need a living body to survive. So he wants to possess her body now, I guess more fully than he could do as a ring creature.
Yeah. So she decides to get a saw and cut her finger off.
Yes, she has her saw moment.
Yeah, she does.
She doesn't cut her finger off, though. But we have an image we've gotten before where, in for example, Attack of the Graveyard Ghouls, where this thing starts pressing down on her as it invades her body and she starts feeling cold, which is the same sensation that was described in that book. I'm going to add to our checklist of Series 2000 things, body snatching. There has been a lot of it.
Yeah, and body squeezing.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, not being in the ring makes her able to get the ring off. So she puts it on Chirpy.
Poor Chirpy.
Yeah, and then it goes back in the ring and it seems dead. She's like, ah, it wanted life, but I gave it death.
Yeah, cool.
Took care of that then.
Quotable quotes.
Yeah, she buries Chirpy in the backyard and is like, I better tell them not to dig him up.
This you've brought up before, like if a parent is overhearing their goose kid, what it sounds like. So her mom, if she's walking by the garage, hears her singing, I got rid of the evil. And then sees her burying a small box with a dead bird in it out in the backyard.
Yeah. But her mom wasn't home. Her mom was bringing Amanda to the mall. Where Amanda wanted a ring just like Beth's, and now she has one and has a cold look on her face.
Yeah, and the ring has a face in it. Or looks like it has a face in it.
The end.
So I guess it wasn't special.
Well, that's the thing.
It's like a Tamagotchi.
I mean, yes. Like, that's something I want to get into in theories. I was like, oh, I was thinking it'd be like, you know, handcrafted and forged in the whatever. But no, it's from the mall.
Well, what has Slappy taught us, right? Like, it can be handcrafted and forged from whatever, but it's, like, not the only one.
Exactly. You can be special and then mass manufactured.
Which is Arlstein's theory of literature.
It's true.
Let's taxonomize this guy.
Let's do it.
He's just not that into you. Not a horror taxonomy. Well, somewhat a horror taxonomy, but from a slant because it's just uncomfortable.
Yeah.
When you see someone going after a person who is not that great and not interested in them.
Yeah, that sucks.
Some of my favorite examples of this are the Maria Bamford show, where she tries to go on dates with kind of bland men in Duluth who, despite how bland they are, still feel totally empowered to disrespect her.
Yeah.
And Danny, I feel like he's like basic, you know?
Yeah.
And yet she wants so badly for him to like her. And yeah. And then Fun Home the Musical, where middle Allison, the college age Allison, is like, I signed up to make posters for a Take Back the Night event. I don't know why I did it. I don't know what that is. Because she wants to get in someone's pants is the reason.
I'm surprised you didn't have on there, he's just not that into you.
I didn't because I haven't seen it or read it.
Yeah, it's awkward. Shrill is another one, the Hulu series.
Okay.
Where the protagonist is dating this guy
who's
just a loser.
I'd only seen the first episode, but yeah. Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, that one just makes me sad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's just, I mean, I think it's a power differential thing, right? What do you have?
Corruption of the Good.
Oh, yes.
There's a new movie on Netflix called Choose or Die, which sort of goes in this direction. It's about a game that makes you choose or die.
Choose what?
Something that
like,
tells
would you
that,
rather?
Yeah.
Would you rather have 10 duck wings or no human arms?
So, wait, with the 10 duck wings, would you also have human arms?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I guess I'd rather have 10 duck wings.
I don't know.
Except the choice would be 10 duck wings or die.
Oh. Yeah. I'll take the wings then. Yeah. Give him cake too.
Cake or death. Yeah.
Is it just an Eddie Izzard sketch?
Yeah.
That you've mistaken for a horror series because you're tired?
Yeah, because I don't understand Episcopalianism. Well, there's also Advent Calendar, the movie we watched a little while ago, where it forces you to make hard choices. There's the Black Mirror episode, Shut Up and Dance, sort of, which is about people being blackmailed to do things. Like, it's kind of based on the collar bomber incident, but mm-hmm. blackmailed to, like, rob a store and things like that.
And it's, like, corruption of the innocent where, like, that's the goal, right? There's something set up to... That part of the fun is taking someone who's good and making them bad.
Yeah, and in that, the twist is kind of, actually, you didn't know what the blackmail was.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually is like, oh, they deserved it or whatever.
It's kind of like when you look at something like The Exorcist 2, where part of why... it's the devil so bad is because he takes like an innocent child and makes her do bad things.
Yeah.
And so it's so much the more unholy, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. I have one slightly related. I called it The Devil Made Me Do It. Remember, we were trying to think of examples of this earlier. I was asking for help in this. Maybe Goosepunks, you can think of some. It's so common where you have scenes where someone sees their body, which has been taken over, doing stuff and they can't stop it from doing those things. And I was having a hard time actually thinking of examples. I just know the trope. But one example I thought of was the series Buffy the Vampire Slayer and also the series Angel, the character being Angel, who he was kind of a schmuck before he got turned into a vampire, but not evil. And then once he becomes a vampire, there's a demon inside him, and that's always doing bad things, and he can't do anything about it. And then he gets his soul back, and he's like, oh, I have to feel all the feelings now. So anyway, all of that to say, Beth is kind of having a similar moment where she is invaded by something outside of her, but it's kind of melding into her personality in a way, and yet she's seeing herself as kind of distinct from it.
Yeah.
It's a very Jungian situation. You said Monkey Bone, also, the Brendan Fraser movie. Have you seen like this? I have not seen Monkey Bone, sadly.
You don't need to.
Doesn't it have Pee Wee Herman?
No. It has...
someone like that.
Some late 90s comedian, Chris someone.
Oh. Pratt? No.
No.
Catan?
Yes, Chris Kattan.
Yeah. What else do you have?
Ruining the school event.
Ah, I love that.
So there's Carrie, Prom Night, Prom Night 2, Never Been Kissed, which I know is not a horror movie, but it kind of is a horror movie.
Yeah.
It's about a high school teacher crushing on a who he thinks is a high school girl.
Yes, not unlike the Series 2000 book. Also, You Can't Scare Me.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is, and Go Eat Worms, mm-hmm. Ruining the Science Fair.
Yeah,
liquids and gases.
This had Go Eat Worms energy also.
It did. And then as I was researching this, I found out that there's also a school carnival trope on TV Tropes.
Oh.
Which includes Never Been Kissed, Grease, and Daria, where it's like, we're having a carnival to raise money for the school. But the one in Daria is a lot like this in that they need their roof fixed or something, the school does. And they put on this very elaborate carnival, so elaborate that they clearly spent more money on the carnival than they needed, like, than they could have raised.
Yeah.
Which is how this one feels. It's like, okay, we're going to spend money on ingredients for food, on renting carnival equipment, on art supplies.
I mean, it's kind of like a expensive plate dinner thing, though. If people are paying a dollar for a ticket, they want to be shown a nice time.
That's true. You don't want to shortchange your donors.
I mean, I think like with so many quote-unquote for charity things, the point is really to keep everyone busy.
Yeah, probably.
Distract them from the fact that the school's not very well-funded or good.
Yeah. What else you got?
Cursed Ring.
Oh.
And my examples of this include Norse mythology and the ultimate fan fiction based on Norse mythology, which is Lord of the Rings. I mean, the ring changes size to match Beth's hand. She can't stop staring at it. It invades her. She becomes a different person because of it. Obviously, R.L. Stein would have read Lord of the Rings, or at least have been unable to avoid knowing a lot about it because of the kind of reading he does.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
Cursed Ring. Also, when I was looking up stuff about magic rings and narrative, someone has really gone out of their way on user-edited pages on the internet, like TV Tropes and Wikipedia, to insist that the rings in Sonic the Hedgehog are magic rings of the kind you get in Norse mythology. They're like, it's not, no one gives this enough attention as a kind of magic ring.
That's cute. Well, relatedly, I had passing on the curse.
Ooh.
In you may recognize this trope from such examples as The Ring.
Mm-hmm.
Truth or Dare, It Follows, where sometimes it's a physical object that you're passing along, sometimes it's more metaphorical, but that's kind of what happens here. Miss Gold essentially passes the curse onto Beth, and arguably Beth passes it on to Amanda in the form of letting her see the ring and sort of covet it.
Yeah. No, I think that happens with It Came from Beneath the Kitchen Sink.
Yeah.
And we've seen it in other Goose books, too, like whoever threw Slappy in the dumpster.
Yeah, or The Unloved, right? Her Carly Beth's brother tries the mask on at the very end.
Yeah, there's just this idea, almost like evil can't be destroyed, you can just try to avoid it.
Yeah, pawn it off on someone else. Mm-hmm. Some other sucker.
Yeah, or become it, and then live and that's a way of pawning it off on someone else, too.
Yeah.
If you don't want to be bullied, you can become the bully.
Mm-hmm.
My next one was related to that, actually. It's fun to be the bad guy.
Uh-huh.
And my main example for this is Breaking Bad, where he pretends to be like, oh, I'm so broken up about it. Kind of like Beth here, but actually clearly really enjoys being a drug lord. Carly Beth is relieved to finally get to kind of boomerang her personality around and get revenge on all the people who are mean to her. I will say, though, that I think Carly Beth has a much more intentionality in the way she takes out her frustration,
mm-hmm.
whereas it seems like Beth really just actually, we've unleashed a kind of sociopathic side of her.
Yeah, it becomes completely indiscriminate.
Right.
I mean, one of the people she sort of terrorizes is her friend Tina,
mm-hmm.
who's been nice to her,
mm-hmm.
puts a mouse in her soup. I mean, I feel worse for the mouse, but still.
I know.
My next one was Ominous Favorite Teacher.
Mm.
I thought of The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie by Muriel Spark, which is about this teacher in the 1930s who has a sort of clique around her of girls who look up to her.
Mm.
She turns out to be a fascist.
Oh, I was going to say that era, she would turn out to be a gay. Because, you know, there was all the concern early 20th century about, like, the things have changed so much. Who's corrupting our children? Which queer people are corrupting our children into That's being true. Queer, right? Because there was this fear that, like, you're going to get them at the age where they're, like, you know, not properly transitioned into heterosexuality, and you'll lead them astray, all single gender environments of some schools, at least.
Well, she leads one student astray by suggesting she go fight in the Spanish Civil War, and she dies.
That seems like a pretty queer thing to do, actually.
Not for the communists, though.
Oh, never mind.
There's also the Shirley Jackson novel, Hangzaman. I still don't know how to pronounce it. The protagonist sort of becomes besotted with one of her professors, and then when she and a couple other girls go to his house, they meet his wife, who was a student, who was besotted with him, and it was like an alcohol problem because he's flirting with all these students in front of her.
Yeah.
And then there's
Only in fiction.
And then there's the novel Confessions by Kone Minato, which is about this teacher who is confronting her students. Like, she's sort of like, she's using her classroom to expose that two of her students were responsible for the death of her daughter. And so everyone thinks she's this sort of, like, nice person and just grieving widow. And she's like, no, I'm going to expose all of this.
That sounds like a super interesting book, first of all, that I would like to read.
It was good.
I also had a teacher category. And I think I want to think a little bit about how this book is a book about teacher-student relationships. Because, you know, they're sharing this secret, right, that they can't talk to anyone else about. And it's making them act in antisocial ways, uncontrollable ways. I feel like there's something in there about teaching being a powerful tool for passing stuff on, but what you might be passing on might be dangerous, right? What might be passed on to by your teacher might be dangerous.
That's true.
But what I had was a transitional object teacher. I had originally called this category Teacher is Sus, but then I put Miss Honey from Matilda on here, and I didn't want to call her that, but because she was my crush, you know?
Yeah.
But honestly, Miss Honey kind of was sus, right?
I mean, yeah, she kind of takes someone's child, essentially.
She really does. It's that trope you're always bringing up where someone's just like, oh, this is my child now.
Yeah, oops, I kidnapped them.
In the movie, they threw in some adoption paperwork, at least, with very little understanding of how that works.
Yeah, you just Xerox it from the library.
Right. But loving Annabelle, Matilda, and again, in addition to that, Miss Honey gets a 6-year-old to sort out her childhood emotional problems, you know?
Yeah, to get her a bunch of money.
Yeah, that too. So transitional object teacher is, the concept of a transitional object is when you are leaving the maternal love relationship under psychoanalysis. This is the theory. You need some transitional object that helps you make up for the loss of that perceived, you know, limitless, powerful love. And so children's teddy bears are a kind of transitional object. Alison Bechdel in Are You My Mother talks about her therapists and the people she's dated as various transitional objects too. You know, trying to get back to that unreal but imagined ideal kind of all-encompassing love.
Yeah.
And so it makes sense that in adolescence, as you're breaking off from your parents, the other people who are giving you attention all the time, like teachers, go and fill that role.
I mean, I think a number of us can relate to accidentally calling your teacher mom.
Yeah.
That's, I mean, it's horrifying, but right. It also speaks to that role, right, that they fulfill, especially at a young age.
Mm-hmm.
Where you're like, ah, you are the one in charge of me right now.
Better than accidentally calling your partner mom, which also many of us have done.
Ew.
Well, sometimes I've been annoyed by a partner in the same way that my parent annoys me, and I just didn't, it just came out, because you're back in that emotional place, and this is why I'm in therapy. I'm dating you now.
Yeah, that's true. You've not done that to me, which I appreciate. So my last one was child developing violent impulses. I thought about, we need to talk about Kevin, The Bad Seed, home movie, like mm-hmm. all of these things about sort of, usually from the parent's perspective of realizing that there's something wrong with your child and not just, you know, oh, I'm playing these childish games, but, oh, this person is dangerous. And I wonder if from the mother's perspective, that's what's happening with Beth.
Yeah, and not knowing kind of what caused it or if it was always there and it's just being revealed. You see Beth at a moment like this where this other side of her is starting to come out and you don't know what released it. Makes me think of my friend Dahmer also, where Jeffrey mm-hmm. Dahmer went from, you know, dissecting cow eyeballs and things to, which you can pass off as normal kid weirdness, to needing to heavily self-medicate to try to keep himself from killing people.
I originally had my friend Dahmer in this category too, yeah.
Well, I had a similar category, which I called The Children Are in Danger and Dangerous. So Hard Candy is an example of that. The TV show we've been watching one episode of so far, The Baby, which is about a baby who seems to cause evil around him, but also is a baby and needs to be protected.
Yeah.
And I was reading the TV Tropes page on the trope of, like, definitely willing to hurt a child. And it was, like, talking about how easy it is to flip that around where you go from being like, well, no one could, you know, hurt a child. That'd be the worst thing. And then you have characters who do. But then sometimes the show or story wants to justify it by being like, but the kid was evil, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
And disturbingly, some of the narrative satisfaction comes from seeing the adult break taboos by putting a stop to the bad child.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, it's intense. It's like, why is this the narrative satisfaction?
Yeah, absolutely.
What are you all repressing, audience?
Yeah, seriously.
So that was my last taxonomy, but I did have one other example I just wasn't sure where to fit in, was that this whole thing reminded me of the Stephen King story, The Outsider, and then the TV series based on that too, where you have a beloved teacher suddenly revealed to be doing something really horrible to one of the students, or about to, it seems like. In this case, she gets stopped.
And then there's actually some outside force controlling that person.
Exactly.
It wasn't actually them.
But no one's, is someone going to come around and reveal that it wasn't really her? I think that, in this case, Miss Gold might just be out of a job.
Yeah, I think she's going to have a hard time. She's got to make a career transition, I think.
Mm-hmm. Okay, do you want to talk about the shared universe?
Let's do it.
So, I'm going to get back to hands.
Hands.
So.
Manos, hands of fate.
Carly Beth's head is to the haunted mask, as two clasped hands are to this book, as the central art images. And remember, Carly Beth's head was a symbol of love.
And this is a symbol of brotherhood?
Yeah. Any thoughts?
Well, love, quote-unquote, resolved the haunted mask. I feel like,
because she learned to love herself, or learned that she was loved?
Yeah, basically. And it chased away the monster. I feel like, you could make that argument here, because Beth ultimately decides not to crash all of the bikes, which you could interpret
that's
as
a kind of brotherhood.
But mostly it's her alone. She doesn't have a brother. I feel like, whereas it's more an emotional journey for Carly Beth, learning to love herself, etc., I feel like what Beth learns is, I don't need brotherhood. like brotherhoods for chumps. You know, if I emphasize brotherhood and goodiness, I just get picked on.
Ooh, but if I want to get with Danny, I need to act like I am not a monster who tries to crash everyone's bike or skips out on the charity event. So True. She's kind of learning both. Like, brotherhood is as phony as the painting she tries to make of it, as unconvincing, and yet it could be strategic. You could sell it for a few dollars.
Yeah, exactly. There you go. Does Evan Ross's dad show his work at this carnival?
Yes, this is the exact same carnival, 100%. We are in Atlanta. That's what's happening. Maybe it's the same timeline.
Yeah, maybe.
I was also
wondering... Well, there are laptops in this one.
Oh. Time moves so weirdly in Monster Blood because, you know, it doesn't seem like years pass the way normal years pass.
That Monster Blood was like a year after the original.
Uh-huh.
So.
Okay.
Maybe not.
But, yeah, there probably wouldn't be laptops then.
But maybe, again, Evan Ross's dad has graduated from the local elementary school to some other elementary school.
Well, actually, speaking of Monster Blood, I was wondering, this seems like a Sarah Beth creation to me, right?
Yeah.
Like, get some junk and, like, do something nonsensical to it.
This is from her Etsy store, for sure.
Yeah. Aw. Yeah, my shared universe question was, what the fuck is this ring, and how does it connect to other stuff?
So, actually, my question was, how does this ring compare to the Unloved, which you've kind of already raised?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's different, though, right? So, we've got, on the one hand, the symbol of brotherhood and the symbol of love. And then we have the Unloved, and we have the ring. And the ring goes on your hand, and the mask goes on your face.
That's true. That is how those...
move from heads to hands.
Items of clothing work. Yeah, that is how those work.
Thank you.
I was feeling more like the Unloved wants to take over the body of the person, just like the thing in the ring does.
Mm-hmm. Okay, this is the English professor in me talking, but I think you have to think about the movement from the face, the head, where your brain's at and stuff. To the hands that are more about, like, the doing, right?
Well, we have to think about it. What am I supposed to think about it? English professor, tell me.
What do we have to think about it? I think that in Arlstein's well-thought-out decision and very intentional decision to look back to Haunted Mask at this moment and say, what is Haunted Mask for Series 2000? What he was doing is he was saying, you know, it's a moving... from the head, that was that series. It was very philosophical. My original series was very heady. A lot of ideas. And then Series 2000 is like...
not so many ideas.
It's the gore fest.
Yeah.
And so I have moved from a psychological thriller to a slasher. And so we're moving from the head to the hands, right? There's no longer any ideals. There's no longer any cohesive structure because we're in a degraded universe.
Cool. I'm going to write that down and submit... it in a paper as if I thought of it.
Okay.
Sounds good. English class.
Who are you submitting papers to?
You, the English professor.
Oh. And we presume that I just forget what I say in class and then...
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's probably true.
No, probably what you'll do is be annoyed. Like, ugh, you just said back to me what I said to you.
Yes. Pro tip. None of your teachers want that.
There was something else you asked. Where does the ring fit in the universe?
So I asked, how does it connect to other stuff? So I was like, it reads to me like a Sarah Beth creation. We talked about a bit. It also has a ghoul logic to it, which, you know, we talked about where it seems to be the same force or the same sensation, at least, of being possessed by the thing that's in it.
It's like a portable ghoul, though. It lives in the ring. You can pass it along. It doesn't have to live in the graveyard. It doesn't have to directly body jump. It seems like it generates some sort of power from making people do things.
And actually, the image on the cover does look a bit like a ghoul. It looks kind of like rotting and it's missing little body parts and stuff. So yeah, maybe it's a kind of ghoul spirit that's just learned to travel in this ring.
Well, if we think about Slappy, too, one of the alleged, you know, reasons behind Slappy is it was a wizard's soul that got trapped in
there.
That's true. So it might be similar where, oh, there's some sort of evil force that got trapped here, but it knows how to get out.
Yeah, that makes total sense to me. It makes me kind of wonder if the Monster Blood also has a soul trapped in it. Because it was just a random object, right? And then Sarah Beth put the...
Aunt Catherine person put it in there.
Or Aunt Catherine put it. Oh, I always forget that it was Aunt Catherine.
Yeah.
What you were saying about Slappy reminded me also how there was that slug creature in his head.
Yeah.
And that image on the cover almost looks like a cross between a ghoul and that, like, weird buggy, sluggy creature.
I mean, maybe that was just the larval form and it grew up into this.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a kind of whatever is possessing Slappy.
Yeah.
Or actually just making him have motility.
Man, when we get... yeah, it's true. It's a different way of being mobile. When we get to Slappy World, I feel like things are just going to be so much more confusing.
We have Slappy's Nightmare coming up soon, too.
Oh, is more Slappy in this series?
That's one we actually have the hardcover of. We have the book itself. Wow. Instead of just having to read it online. It's kind of exciting. Did you have any other shared universe stuff or thoughts about the ring and how to make sense of it?
To roll over a little bit into theories, my question was basically, what is the deal with the ring? Because it seems at first like, oh, it's this precious object. It's so mysterious. And then it's like, oh, no, you can get it at the mall.
Yeah.
Which, I don't know. I mean, we've talked about that a little bit, but that was the thing that sort of threw me about it. It's like, oh, are they all filled with ghouls? Was this just something someone, like Monster Blood, someone picked up at the store and then it got cursed?
I mean, it sounds like they're all filled with ghouls. The Galbis ring, that's part of their deal.
Yeah, like a Tamagotchi, like you said.
Yeah. I was thinking that, do you remember who the third person on the carnival committee was besides Beth and Danny?
Tina.
Tina, do you remember her last name?
No.
Crowley.
Oh!
So I was wondering if she is an Aleister Crowley descendant. And if maybe she did a little magic on the ring.
She went to Claire's one day and was like, wait a minute, I got this.
Yeah, she just cursed a row of rings and was like, Tina out.
Yeah. And then it came back to bite her. It's like, damn it, there's a mouse in my soup.
Yeah.
I like that.
And then, yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess it's the same question. What's the missing backstory on the ring? Goosepunks, I'd love to hear your theories or if this has been brought up at all elsewhere. I think we have a very frustrated artisan class in the Gooseverse. They're going around making puppets and making rings and
ghostwriting books.
Ghostwriting books. And they make these beautiful objects and they're really angry because maybe they're having a hard time making a living. They're trying to sell revenge with their bird in a trailer somewhere. It's not working out. Their small business is not getting off the ground.
That's fair.
And so they just start cursing people.
I mean, that seems very plausible to me.
It's like the Fight Club thing where you pee in the soup.
Yeah. Yeah. You make soap out of people's liposuction fat.
Exactly. Well, I wanted to ask you if you were familiar with the inspiration for this story.
No.
Have you heard of a 1959 film called Horrors of the Black Museum?
Yes.
Oh, you know about it?
I just know of it.
Yeah, it's part of what was called the Sadian Trilogy. So like Marquis de Sade, like a sadistic trilogy of British films. Circus of Horrors and Peeping Tom being the other two.
Oh.
And it's this very strange plot where there's this guy who is hypnotizing this other guy, it seems like, to get him to perform evil deeds for him. So I think that's where it ties into this book.
Little Cabinet of Dr. Caligari there.
Yeah, and a little bit Peeping Tom because there's binoculars that stab you in the brain.
Oh.
Because they have hidden blades in them.
I feel like that works less well with a binocular than with a camera because the whole point of binoculars is to be far away, right?
Well, it stabs the wearer.
Oh, the wearer. Oh, yeah. Never mind then.
Yeah. And it's it was actually, so the reason it has this name, Horrors of the Black Museum, is it's based on a bunch of stuff that was kept in what was once called the Black Museum, which is a collection held by Scotland Yard of all this, like, fucked up stuff they've got, like, murders have been done with and stuff.
Ooh.
Yeah. And so, supposedly, the stuff in the movie is based on stuff they actually had in their collection.
Much like the Conjuring franchise.
Yeah, that's a good point. It came out in 1959, and it was released in the U.S. on a double bill with The Headless Ghost.
What?
Yeah. And apparently it was pretty popular, and the main audience of the film was between 12 and 26. So I feel like this is right aimed at Arlstein. Like, you know, he's pulling back into his kid memory of seeing a double feature of The Headless Ghost. And he's like, what was the other thing? Oh, yeah, Horrors of Black Museum. Let me change one of those words.
Totally.
And then I will hand it off to my ghostwriter.
Yeah, totally. Oh, I love that. I want to watch it now. And also the rest of that trilogy.
Me too. Yeah, I think it sounds super interesting. I guess there, according to Wikipedia at least, there was kind of a shift. The film critic, David Peary, has talked about this, talks about it. These films as being a shift towards sadism, cruelty, and violence, in contrast to the supernatural horror of the Hammer films of the same era, which now that I'm saying that, I'm like, that is the difference between Goosebumps, the original series, and Goosebumps series 2000, as I was describing it between the Carly Beth head plot and the hands plot here.
Oh, you're so right. I love that distinction.
Yeah. Thank you.
So my last point, I was thinking about the carnival. And I was wondering if this has any relationship to the carnivalesque.
Ooh,
What do you remember about the carnivalesque from your grad school days?
F. There's this French guy, Rabelais.
Oh, yeah. He wrote a book about Rabelais, but yes.
Who were you saying?
Bakhtin,
yes. And
anyway, Anyway.
Wrote about the carnivalesque. I mean, this is the thing. It's all these 20th century people writing about these 18th century people and being like, ugh, why do they talk about poop so much? And why did they talk about gross stuff so much? And the answer is because they were bored. And there was a lot of cheap print available. Like, you could just write anything. Not a lot of censorship. A lot of printing presses. So the Carnivalesque is this idea of kind of letting loose during a carnival. You know, people can maybe turn some rules around. The peasant can push around a lord. A person can act as a gender other than the gender they normally act as. Basically all the stuff we normally don't talk about because of propriety. Now we're just going to make a bunch of jokes about, like, poop.
So Mikhail Bakhtin, this Russian theorist, wrote about this in Rabelais and in Dostoevsky. And he also wrote about the sort of carnivalization of literature, right? Where these are the things that happen in the sort of medieval carnival, and they also happen in the novel. And so there are a couple of things that he points out about this, which you've raised a couple of these. And I was wondering if we could see these points in the book at all. So one is familiar and free interaction between people. So as you were saying, right, lords and peasants can interact on sort of more equal ground than in everyday life.
Like teachers and students in this book.
Yeah, absolutely. She just goes and fucking snatches a student.
Yeah. Or across, she's like, I'm just an ordinary girl and Danny's the coolest guy in school, you know?
Yeah. Eccentricity, which is where behavior, gesture, and discourse that are normally considered eccentric and inappropriate are encouraged, permitting the latent sides of human nature to reveal and express themselves.
Yeah, like cackling to your ring. Does this include antisocial behavior too, like shoving children into lockers?
Yeah, totally. Let's see. Carnivalistic mésalliance. Any sort of dualistic separation reunites. So you have sacred and profane, high and low, great and small.
Yeah, it's like, that's what I was saying Jung earlier, that she gets to have her demonic self not repressed anymore.
Yeah.
She can be the goody-goody and the demon.
And then there's profanation, so rules of piety and respect for official notions of the sacred are stripped of their power. So there's blasphemy, obscenity, debasings.
Mangling hamsters.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's true, right?
Yeah. And also at the carnival itself, right, all these, like, things that are supposed to be money-making mechanisms for the school are destroyed. Do a lot of property damage, actually.
Yeah, I mean, bursting into flames, a food table bursting into flames seems like a pretty satanic image, right?
Yeah.
If you're thinking in a medieval sort of tradition.
And then the last point I wanted to bring up is he talks about how the primary act of carnival is the mock crowning and subsequent decrowning of a carnival king.
Oh, yeah.
It is a dualistic ambivalent ritual that typifies the inside-out world of carnival and the joyful relativity of all structure and order.
So that would be her putting the ring on and taking it off.
Taking it from her teacher, maybe?
Yeah.
Like, the teacher.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, teacher had this power but loses it, and now she has it.
Even though she's the, you know, the fool or whatever, she's not, not in a position of power, but then she gets to take on the power for a little bit and cause a bunch of mischief. That's perfect. You're absolutely right. This is a Carnivalesque novel.
Yes.
Yeah.
A for me?
A plus.
Sweet. Yeah. The paper's gonna be late. By the way,
it's a 99%, though.
It's very withholding of you.
You like it. Well, Goosepunks, we want to know what you think of the Series 2000 Goosebumps work, Horrors of the Black Ring.
But before they tell us, you tell me. On a scale of 1 to 5 bewares, what would you give Horrors of the Black Ring?
This book was weird, and I enjoyed reading it, and I kept being like, what? And you know, for me, that gives a book points.
Yeah.
So I would give it a 3.5.
I'd give it the same for the same reason. You know, it's funny. Before I had read it, but after Andy had read it, Andy said to me, oh, I want to read the dream sequence for my quote. I said, that's fine. And so as I was reading it, we got to that gym carnival scene where things are exploding and on fire. And I was like, oh, this is totally the dream sequence, whatever. And then it turned out not to
be.
And I was shocked. And I was impressed by that, frankly. Yeah.
It didn't let you down.
Mm-hmm.
That's high praise, honestly.
Yeah. Till the end, maybe. But yeah.
Well, did it let you all down? Let us know. You can get in touch with us on Twitter or Instagram at SayPodAndDie.
You can send us an email at SayPodAndDie@gmail.com.
You can also give us 5 bewares on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get this podcast. And leave us a review. Tell us how much you like it, please. And if you don't like it, tell us privately.
Yeah, or just not at all.
Yeah, I mean, that's even better. I don't need more criticism in my life. What are we reading next?
Next week, we are taking a journey back into the 90s with even more tales to give you goosebumps, the third installment in the short story series.
Yeah, and it seems like there's been some hype on our Twitter account. We're in for a good time, apparently.
Excellent. So we'll be back with the first of a three-part series on that book.
Listener beware.
Those were the scares.
Good boo.
Good boo.
I went to bed late that night, haunted by dreams. It's dark, I murmured to myself. It's so dark. I'm in a maze, I realized. I have to feel my way through. But where am I going, I wondered. At last I could see. I stood in the gym, surrounded by ducks. Only, instead of duck heads, they all had human heads. One duck head looked exactly like Danny Jacobs. The next one looked like Tina Crowley. Another duck was Anthony Gonzalez. This isn't right, I screamed. Your heads don't belong on duck bodies. I grabbed the Anthony duck and tore its head off. Blood gushed from its neck. Feathers flew into the air. Ha ha ha! I laughed. I splashed my hand in the blood and rubbed it on the black ring. This will get the ring off, I cackled. Blood will take it off.